Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, on collaborative governance. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and leadership fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Each week, my goal is straightforward: to introduce you to key government executives and thought leaders who are tackling significant management challenges and seizing opportunities to lead. To complement these examples of leadership in action, I also highlight the practical, actionable recommendations made by some of the most recognized and respected thought leaders in public management. A decade ago, public management scholar Don Kettle declared that the government was failing to meet public expectations because many of the most important problems we face simply do not match the institutions we've created to govern them. He observed that many challenges have no single organization in charge to deal with them. As a result, the traditional bureaucratic institutions defined by hierarchical agencies and programs that were so successful in the mid-20th century are not adequate for the challenges that span across organizational boundaries. The traditional hierarchical model of governing is increasingly being supplemented with a collaborative network model. Some stable and focused governmental functions remain under the hierarchical model, while other more fluid and dynamic functions are adopting a more network-based collaborative approach. This network collaborative model is still evolving and growing in importance within agencies, between levels of government, and between the public, private, and nonprofit sectors. Don Kettle, author of several IBM Center reports, elaborates.
First is this inability to span boundaries. Most of the problems that government faces have to do with managing across boundaries, not so much managing programs themselves, but managing the connections between programs. And that turns out to be the case in 25 out of the 32 different areas in the high-risk list. 25 out of the 32 are really boundary management problems, which is perhaps surprising to a lot of people that there is that much commonality and that the commonality has to do with this reaching across boundaries piece. Government employees to do their job need the skills that are required for 21st century government, which then gets back to the problem of managing across boundaries because there's no more important 21st century skill set than that. Some of these issues just are hard, and they're hard technologically and require not only people with the skills to do it, but also an approach that allows government to be as smart as partners that it's working with, both in other agencies, in other levels of government, but especially in the private sector.
The concept of collaborative governance, that is, working jointly across the traditional boundaries of governmental agencies and between the public and private sectors, has proven an effective strategy for implementing policy initiatives over the past two decades in an increasingly interdependent environment. The descriptive terms for these phenomena vary. Networks, collaborations, partnerships, horizontal government, boundary spanning, joined up government, and many more. This evolution has resulted from the need for new business models to address societal challenges where the traditional hierarchical organizational model is no longer effective. The evolution is also driven by the availability of new technologies that lower cross-functional collaboration barriers which existed in the past. My colleague John Kaminsky, author of the IBM Center report, Cross-Agency Collaboration, a Case Study of the Cross-Agency Priority Goals, provides some historical context.
Well, cross-agency collaboration has been around for a long time, but it's always been sort of ad hoc. And it's oftentimes been around a particular initiative or project. So, for example, the Federal Emergency Management Agency would have a response to Katrina and need or Hurricane Sandy, and they would need to bring different agencies together to have a single federal face to the communities in which they're working. But this whole notion of collaboration across agencies has reached across a lot of other policy domains. So we're talking about the intelligence community working across agency boundaries. We're talking about in food safety working across agency boundaries and across for social services, et cetera. And it's at the federal, state, and local level. And this is something that is because there's an increasing complexity in how government interacts with citizens. But it's also there is a shift in expectations by citizens of how government will interact with them. And part of that comes from the technology that's evolved over the past couple decades, that people are now expecting different kinds of services from the private sector. They're also having that same expectation that government itself will begin to integrate the way it works.
What drives the use of collaborative governance? Professor Rosemary O'Leary describes how government has steadily increased its use of collaborative approaches in lieu of the traditional hierarchical and bureaucratic approach. She says there are several explanations for this shift. First, most public challenges are larger than any one organization, requiring new approaches to addressing public issues, such as housing, pollution, and transportation and healthcare. Second, collaboration to improve the effectiveness and performance of programs by encouraging new ways of providing services. Third, technology advances in recent years have helped organizations and their employees to share information in a way that is integrative and interoperable. And finally, citizens are seeking additional avenues for engaging in governance, resulting in new and different forms of collaborative problem solving and decision making. The use of collaborative networks that cross organizational boundaries has a long history. Many of the early networks evolved in response to specific needs at the state and local levels, dealing with practical problems, such as sharing firefighting equipment and staff in emergencies via mutual aid agreements, joint economic development initiatives, or addressing natural resources issues in a common watershed. While state and local networks have tended to emerge bottom-up, networks at the federal level seem to be largely an outgrowth of top-down initiatives to improve cross-agency or state and federal coordination efforts. In such areas as grants management, avoiding duplicating capital investments in hospital equipment in a common geographical area, or working across agency boundaries that shared a common geographical boundary. But it's not easy. Once again, my colleague John Kaminsky explains.
Well, government has been designed around a hierarchy to create accountability and responsibility to citizens. And so we have the Congress has appropriations, and the appropriations are targeted to specific programs. And if programs want to work together, they have to be able to combine across appropriation accounts. And many times that's not possible. The other thing is that there's the authorizing statutes for money programs that are treated everything as a program and not a suite of programs that can be worked as an enterprise approach to citizens. So the government is designed to work in pieces that are accountable in a hierarchical structure upwards. And a collaborative approach means that you want to deal with government horizontally, cutting across programs, cutting across agencies. And the government's not designed to do that. And that's because the accountability structure is done that way. So if you look at there's, you know, several dozen laws in different agencies that were created by different committees and are funded through different streams of money to create permits and permissions to build infrastructure. Some of it's out of EPA, some of it's out of Interior, some of it's out of transportation. And yet, when you're trying to build a bridge, all these laws come together, and sometimes they conflict, or sometimes they have to be done in sequence as opposed to in parallel. And it can take years to do a project that, on the face of it, would look very simple and straightforward, but it's very complex because of the different statutes and different authorities and different agencies. So the challenge is how do you begin working this together from the customer or the user or the regulated entity's perspective so that it's not this seemingly endless do loop?
Some networks evolved based on entrepreneurial efforts of leaders at the agency level within larger organizations. Two examples of federal-level collaborative initiatives that reached beyond their own agency boundaries include the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Safe Construction Networks, launched in the late 1990s, and a Department of Health and Human Services initiative to improve community-level health care. Ultimately, the FEMA pioneering network did not survive the transition from the Clinton to the Bush administration, but it offered clear lessons to other federal agencies on the importance of strong interpersonal skills and considerable political acumen in order to interact effectively. Similarly, Professor Jane Fountain, author of the IBM Center report, Implementing Cross-Agency Collaboration, A Guide for Federal Managers, identifies three sets of skills needed to build and sustain cross-agency collaborative management.
So let's start here with the basics. Whether a manager is working across boundaries or within an agency, they have to do the following things to work toward a goal or to make a project or program effective. First, they need to marshal the right expertise and talent, find the right people for the task or the project at hand. Secondly, they need to find and hold on to, sustain, the resources they need. And those resources have to be commensurate with, they have to be aligned with the task, the project, the goal. The third thing that has to happen is a development, if they're not already there, of systems, of practices, of procedures for the type of problem solving that will be needed, for the decisions that will have to be made, and for resolving conflicts that are inevitable and that will have to be surfaced and discussed and resolved to an extent enough so that the process can go forward. They may not ever be fully resolved. We call this quasi-resolution of conflict. And then they have to develop and be able to monitor and enforce a set of rules that have to do with who will do what the pacing of this project will be, what the deliverables will be, what practices will be germane to the process. So all managers have to do those things all the time. What's different when you're working across boundaries? You're often working without formal authority, and here's where the new legislation is so important, because it's adding in some of that authority that wasn't there. Traditionally, experts and researchers have talked about something called indirect management, managing without formal authority, the use of persuasion, the use of negotiation, of conflict resolution becomes very important, because you can't simply order people to do things. It's not clear that you can ever really just order people to do things and expect them to be done. But when you're working across boundaries, these indirect management skills are even more important.
More importantly, what triggered agencies like FEMA and HHS to undertake efforts like this on their own initiative at an agency level within the federal government? In both cases, leaders of these initiatives said their efforts responded to the adoption of the Government Performance and Results Act of 1993, which requires agencies to develop plans and measures of performance. This act signaled a shift in managerial attention from processes, programs, and activities to achieving mission-focused results. This new focus highlighted the need to collaborate more actively with stakeholders beyond their programs and agencies. Recent changes in law and advances in technology have led to a new environment that makes cross-agency collaborative management far more achievable. Jane Fountain describes the key aspects of this new environment for cross-agency collaboration and the political realities of today that make cross-agency collaboration a necessity.
Well, there are several things to talk about here. First, we have an administration that's highly interested in modernizing the apparatus of the federal government. President Obama said in 2011 something that's been widely quoted. I'll quote it here. We cannot win the future with a government built for the past. We live and do business in the information age, but the organization of the federal government has not kept pace. So that top leadership emphasis is quite important. Second, this is a radio show for IBM. Technology and technological innovations have made it so much easier technologically to communicate across agency boundaries, to share information, to share data, and to share operations and procedures across agencies. So in a nutshell, the coordination costs of working across agencies are lower because of technology. Now, there are lots of other challenges, but technologically, there's a potential there that people sense and want to realize. There's complete recognition at this point in our history that complex policy problems, here's another area, lie across boundaries. We're not going to change the organization of all of our agencies, but we have problems like disaster relief, which we're facing right now, food safety, homeland security, social welfare problems that lie across the boundaries of several agencies. We can't address these problems without cross-boundary projects. And then last but not least, certainly not least, economic efficiency is critical. We waste taxpayer money when we have excessive redundancy across the government. And that kind of redundancy always has a habit of growing up across agencies over time. And from time to time, we need to go through and streamline things and reduce overlap. So those are some of the reasons why cross-agency collaboration is really critical right now.
In the 1990s and early 2000s, all levels of government experimented with different forms of inter-organizational collaborative networks. Some were emergent and bottom-up, some mandated and top-down. Some were event-specific, local responses to floods. Some were geographically specific, watershed improvements. And some were population-specific, reducing healthcare disparities. But this approach gained traction in public management and moved beyond the experimental phase, expanded into other policy domains, and scaled to larger, more complex public challenges. How has the use of collaborative networks expanded in the management of government? We'll explore this question and so much more when our special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, returns. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on collaborative governance. Collaborative networks tend to be institutionally fragile, as seen in some examples presented earlier, that were initially successful but disbanded over time. They depend heavily on the development of interpersonal trust between stakeholders, high-level executive champions to provide a sense of legitimacy, and the availability of network leaders who are skilled in managing across boundaries and can serve as neutral brokers and facilitators rather than as more traditional top-down strong leaders. Networking is hard work and time-consuming because of the coordination and transaction cost imposed on the network's leaders and participants. In fact, collaboration is not an easy answer to hard problems, but in fact it is a hard answer to hard problems. Efforts have been undertaken to reduce challenges and improve the chances for the sustainability of networked approaches. In recent years, progress has been made in three ways: enhancing organizational capacity to act via the use of networks, enhancing staff capacity to work in the networks, and developing a capacity to measure and assess the progress of networked initiatives. Probably the most prominent marker for the move to institutionalize the use of collaborative networks was the passage of the GPRA Modernization Act of 2010, which advanced progress in each of these three areas. Once again, John Kaminsky, author of the IBM Center report, Cross-Agency Collaboration, a Case Study of the Cross-Agency Priority Goals, explains.
One of the things that evolved prior to 2010 were these ad hoc working groups to get the Government Performance and Results Act of 93 shifted the focus of many programs and the government from focusing on spending money and doing activities to organizing around results to be achieved. And those results oftentimes reached across agency boundaries. And what they found was that there's no statutory authority to work across agency boundaries on a regular basis. Could be done ad hoc, one agency takes the lead or something like that. But if you wanted to create some sort of institutional mechanism to do that, you couldn't through statute until the 2010 law was passed. And that law required the Office of Management Budget to identify a small handful of cross-agency priority goals that the administration would take on for a four-year period. And so some of those had to be mission support and some of them mission delivery. And so they piloted that during the remainder of the first term of President Obama. And then they did the first full set in his second term because the 4 years would be coterminous with a term of office. And so the first – and that's what I assessed, the first full round of cross-agency priority goals. In the pilot stage, they developed some mechanisms and tested them out, and then they wound up applying them in the second phase. So what happened was that the law requires establishing goals, and then it requires this designation of a goal leader. So there's a human being as opposed to some institution, and it's sort of put in charge. And then there'd be quarterly progress reports that would be made to a council or a group of senior government officials. Oftentimes, it's like the director of OMB and maybe White House and others on the progress. And then the summary of that is to be posted on the web for public viewing so that the public can see what the accountability is in the progress around each of the goals. So the first round, full round, had 15 goals.
When the effectiveness of the Government Performance and Results Act was revisited in 2010 by Congress and the administration, it expanded to include provisions that encouraged cross-agency collaboration around common priorities, cross-agency priority goals, or CAP goals. John Kaminsky explores, what are CAP goals?
The cross-agency priority goals in the old world of collaboration were around a specific project that had a beginning, a middle, and an end, like recovery from a hurricane or something. Many of these goals are things that are long-term sustainability. So in some cases, this is kind of like the being designated as a cross-agency priority goal is a kickstart of creating a core team that's able to work together on a sustainable basis over time. And that's where you can wind up saying you can graduate from being a cross-agency priority goal. It doesn't necessarily need – it's not that it's not a priority any longer. It's just that it's self-sustaining and is able to run on its own.
The implementation of the GPRA Modernization Act led to a series of new administrative processes being put in place that provide both legitimacy for the use of collaborative networks and a degree of institutional stability. The law mandated the creation of cross-agency priority goals, led by a designated goal leader. The other important routine was the requirement that cross-agency goal leaders conduct quarterly progress reviews and post their progress and next steps on performance.gov. This ensured an ongoing rhythm and focal point for goal teams to continue meeting and to engage senior government officials in helping address barriers the teams could not solve themselves. A second set of developments over the past decade involved building greater capacity for leaders, managers, and participants to operate in networks. Jane Fountain, author of the IBM Center report, Implementing Cross-Agency Collaboration, a Guide for Federal Managers, notes that effective collaboration consists of two dimensions, people skills and organizational processes. What are the characteristics of an effective collaborative manager? Fountain elaborates.
Okay. There, in the report, I have a table that brings together the skills that various researchers and experts in this area have noted consistently in time after time, study after study, project after project. I list about 25 of them. I think you can boil these down to a couple of areas. First, what consistently comes up in terms of skills are strong interpersonal skills. Managers and executives who can build strong professional relationships. So what's beneath this? You can think of these as sort of sub-skills or skills that allow someone to build strong professional relationships. These are building trust, being fair, having a sense of fairness to multiple parties, flexibility, active listening, and ability to actually take in what different parties with different perspectives are trying to bring to the table. So this requires strong communication skills. And here I note both the listening part of communication as well as a sort of re-articulation and framing of what needs to be done in a way that all parties can sign on to, and then conflict resolution. Another dimension that's important here is a specific kind of leadership. So it's not just that people need leadership skills, but for cross-agency and cross-boundary processes, you need people who see the big picture. When we're thinking of government-wide efforts and goals, that is the big picture here. And these executives are also good at creating shared meaning, a shared direction to be able to envision new or different ways of operating. And they are executives who have the creativity, if you will, to frame and reframe problems in a slightly new way that allows agencies and agency managers to sign on to this different way of doing things.
Collaboration depends critically on the interpersonal skills of individual managers. A director of a successful, large, cross-agency initiative describes his management skills as that of a conductor. Professor Fountain continues.
You know, this metaphor to a conductor is an interesting one, because conductors are not composing the music while they're conducting the orchestra. The composition has been done. The musicians are playing. They may be reading separate parts, right? The trombones, the violins, the percussion, but all of those parts have to come together. So the conductor, remember, does his or her work in a sort of silent but very effective way to bring forward or dampen different parts of the orchestra or the jazz group, whatever they're conducting. And ultimately, they're not there to see the conductor, to see that one group gets what they want all the time, but to meld all of these parts together. So a network broker is a little bit like this, because they are particularly good when they're effective at working with people whose perspectives may differ and crafting something that is going to work for a number of different parties with different constraints. So again, this involves a lot of listening and a sort of creativity to craft something that will be fair. Fairness comes up a lot in terms of skills. Parties sign on when they believe that their views are going to be well and faithfully representative. We think about political leaders building coalitions, typically think about civil servants and bureaucrats making and enforcing rules. But this activity of network brokering is really about building and sustaining coalitions.
So what is the glue that holds together collaborative networks? Jane Fountain provides her perspective.
When I use this term glue in the report as a sort of source of cohesion over time, of stability, right? Glue makes things cohere. It has three components. Trust is one of them. Trust here does not mean unfettered, blind trust in which some mythical agency executive would simply hand over a large swath of their responsibility. No, trust means a kind of certainty, a bet, based on interactions, repeated interactions or transactions, that the other actors in the group are going to come through reliably, that they will do what they've said that they're going to do, and that you can stake activities on that. So trust is critical. So the second dimension of this glue are a set of norms or practices that all the parties agree to and are working under about how decisions will be made, who will have a voice on what types of decisions, how conflicts will be resolved, and basically who has the authority to make what types of decisions in this partnership. And then the third element are networks. There is an identifiable group, a community of practice, if you will, of experts, of managers, of government officials who are working together, who get to know one another's challenges and constraints and their goals, and who have a sense of cohesion and a bit of institutional memory. So those are the three elements of this glue that would hold together a project group of officials across agency boundaries. I refer to it as social capital. There's a stream of research that goes back now well over a decade on social capital. It's an important line of thinking, and this concept of social capital is important because it helps us break through the idea that government executives and agencies are essentially and always self-interested, and so they can only compete, they can never cooperate. If that were the case, we could not talk about cross-agency collaboration. So social capital gives us a language we can use to talk about collaboration that is robust and that is rigorous.
Based on observations over the past 20 years, most effective collaborative networks are not mandated by law in a top-down fashion, but emerge from the community affected largely bottom-up. Participants have to work collaboratively, sharing power and authority. Nevertheless, there is a role for legislative involvement. Legislation can create conditions and grant legitimacy for organizations to work in a collaborative manner, as seen in the GPRE Modernization Act's provisions for the creation of cross-agency priority goals. In addition to the challenges of forming, managing, and sustaining networks, some key best practices have been learned. First, networks can be an effective tool. When applied in the appropriate situation with the right condition in place, collaborative networks can be a powerful tool for solving challenges. Second, there is no one-size-fits-all approach or design. Observing models of different networks in different environments is key for learning how networks actually work. Collaborative networks need to be developed and applied to fit the specific context, and leaders need to build the institutional and organizational processes that can sustain cross-agency action over time. Three, involving the right kind of people is key. Probably the most important lesson is the role of individuals in a collaborative effort. Individuals have to be willing to bring the right mindset to the table, assume good intent by fellow network members, and make activities transparent to the group, and also be flexible about the evolution of the network. Fourth, sustainability of the network is problematic. A consistent observation over time has been that collaborative networks often die, largely because of changes in key players, the lack of legitimacy or authority, or when partners stop contributing resources, either money or people, when priorities change. Government operations oftentimes run in the background, out of public view, hiding how government works in ways that increasingly depend on multiple players for the success in areas in which no single agency has the span of resources or legal authority to act. All of government will not suddenly transition to collaborative networks or governance, and this model is not appropriate for everything that government does. As in the private sector, there will continue to be dual operating systems with traditional hierarchies and collaborative networks operating side by side. Thanks for joining us on the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak on Advancing Collaborative Governance. Be sure to join me next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government and its effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on collaborative governance. In the 2000s, the use of collaborative networks expanded in government. This approach was used at all levels of government in an increasingly complex policy environment involving multi-sector partners. As collaborative networks matured, they often changed their composition of participants, strategic focus, and how they work together. The growing pains of various networks helped identify common challenges that networks face as they strive for long-term sustainability. Addressing these barriers systematically helped pave the path towards institutionalization of collaborative governance as a useful approach for public managers. And we see this in such policy domains as food safety and stewardship land management. Food safety responsibilities have historically been fragmented and decentralized among 16 federal agencies responsible for implementing 30 different laws and a myriad of state, local, and public sector entities. Monica Nogueira, co-author with Noel Gries of the IBM Center report, Food Safety, Emerging Public-Private Approaches, explains and describes the complicated landscape of food safety.
It is difficult to estimate the true extent of food safety disease, but it can be safely be said that foodborne disease occurs more frequently than it is reported, and it incurs more costs than there are estimates for. in the last 10 years, we have had more than 20 major food contamination events that made thousands of people severely ill with very high health and economic costs. These events are distributed across many types of food products, but contaminations of meat, poultry, and fresh produce are the most prominent. We see that there are increasing opportunities for food contamination and that the cost for food contamination events are also increasing. And we think that one of the roots of this problem is the fragmentation of the U.S. food safety system, as well as the lack of authority of our regulatory agencies to mandate recalls, the inadequacy or inexistence of traceability systems and the food supply chain.
Noelle Grease elaborates on how the food safety system works.
So in terms of the complicated structure, there are 15 different agencies and more than 30 different laws that govern food safety at the federal level. And right now, if you sort of try and look at the landscape of the regulatory bodies, the major tasks are divided between the FDA and the USDA. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, oversees about 80% of our food supply, including imported foods, foods that come into our country across borders. And the USDA, or really its FSIS, or Food Safety and Inspection Service, is responsible for the remaining 20%, and that includes meat, poultry, and processed egg products. There are a number of other agencies. The CDC, for example, I think Monica mentioned them earlier, has responsibility for surveillance and epidemiological activities to confirm and monitor and manage foodborne disease outbreaks. You know, the EPA, Department of Homeland Security, because remember, food safety also has a homeland security and terrorism aspect to it as well. They're also involved in food safety. So we have a very complicated structure at the federal level. But in all honesty, the bulk of the food safety work really happens at the local and the state levels. We have thousands of local health departments and various state departments of public health and agriculture all engaged in data gathering and analysis, inspections of various stakeholders and suppliers along the food supply chain.
The food safety policy area may be ripe for greater collaboration, but absent a willingness by key stakeholders, little progress has been made. Noelle Grease and Monica Nogueira, authors of the IBM Center report on the importance of collaboration in ensuring food safety, offer some insights.
I think the public-private aspect of food safety is emerging. I think it's being recognized that we can't necessarily rely just on the public sector, on the FDA and the USDA to help keep our food safe. We've been talking about a new stakeholder model that includes not just the public sector agencies, but also the private sector and also the consumer, who all have roles to play in keeping our food supply safe. Private sector on its own is also engaging in industry-wide efforts to alert suppliers and customers up and down the supply chain if problems are emerging. And it's in their interest that, you know, private sector companies want to maintain their brand. They want to maintain the safety of their products. So it's in their interest as well. These sort of collaborative approaches are really the way to go in the future, and the laws that are coming down also reflect this.
However, absent congressional support and a consensus for action by key stakeholders, little progress has been made, according to a 2017 report by GAO, in part because the U.S. food safety system never envisioned the regulation or coordination of global production and supply chains. In June 2018, the Trump administration's government reorganization plan included a proposal to create a single food safety agency. As collaborative networks evolved in different policy domains, supporting technologies and network models evolved as well. One such example is the use of stewardship contracting as a tool to support frontline collaboration, specifically in ecosystem management of forestlands and watersheds. Cassandra Mosley, author of the IBM Center report, Strategies for Supporting Frontline Collaborations, Lessons from Stewardship Contracting, explains.
So stewardship contracting is a set of contracting authorities that the Forest Service and BLM were given initially through a pilot project in the late 1990s and now through a 10-year authority that allow them to combine the best of service contracting or traditional federal procurement authorities and timber sale contracting, which is the sale of timber. By bringing the sort of the best of both worlds together, that allows them to do on-the-ground restoration work in ways that are just not possible when they only can, you have to use one kind of set of contracting authorities to sell timber and another set of contracting authorities to purchase services. But when you're really working to restore ecosystems on public lands, you really need to have a whole bag of tools together in one contract. It reduces the impact on the land. It creates more local economic benefit. It creates a lot of administrative efficiencies. So stewardship contracting has been something that emerged as an idea in Montana and some other parts of the West and then has burgeoned over the last decade or so across the National Forest System and the Bureau of Land Management.
How is stewardship contracting a tool for cultivating frontline collaboration?
I think that one of the things that is critical to for senior executives perhaps to think through as they one, figuring out how to support their collaboration and their frontline staff in collaboration. It requires really changing thinking and changing structures and changing authorities. And so what I realized as I was looking at these examples of stewardship contracting was that, and the whole process that the agencies had gone through to support it, that one of the key pieces of helping local-level collaboration succeed is helping the frontline staff by creating the time and the space for them to really develop these collaboratives. Another area is to really focus on what are the rules that need to be changed to encourage collaboration. Oftentimes, funding, this may be really focusing on prioritizing funding for actions that have been collaboratively agreed to. If a collaboration comes together, they spend 2 years reaching agreement, and then there's no money to implement the agreement. That burns a lot of bridges pretty quickly, and the collaboration will dissolve. Another critical piece of that is really to think about the importance of local discretion. If there's nothing real, no real decisions to be made at the front line, why would citizens engage in the collaborative process if there's nothing to be worked through? So it's critical that people be able to make decisions at the field level. I think another strategy is to provide real incentives for collaboration, whether that's in through formal guidance and requirements that people collaborate, or aligning organizational and personal performance measures so that people are held accountable for collaborating. In both those cases, you can think about encouraging the people who, making it easier for the people who want to collaborate and creating incentives for the people who are more hesitant. And then finally, the fourth strategy I talk about in the report is to really build the capacity of both the agency and their non-governmental partners to engage in collaboration. And one of the things that's very apparent in stewardship contracting is the importance of well-trained, well-qualified procurement people and staff.
But why is collaboration in this context so hard?
I think there's a lot of diverse reasons why collaboration is hard sometimes. Some of the factors I focus on in this report are really the conflicts between the old institutions that were for hierarchical and the newer desires to collaborate. I think that can be a real area of focus for senior executives. I think at the ground level, at the frontline level, you can both have community reluctance to collaborate sometimes, although I think that's becoming more and more rare, or you can have conflict that's so intense that every time people try to get a group together, it's sabotaged or something like that. You can also see in a land management agency or in other many agencies, people didn't get into the business of being foresters or any number of other federal agencies because they wanted to work with people. They wanted to work with trees, and now they're being asked to work with people. I think, and I do think that the training component and helping the frontline staff understand how to collaborate and what collaboration is a key piece, but also I think there are these larger structural issues that can make it very difficult, whether it's political pressures or lack of authority or just, it's habit. And so habits are hard to break when they're in large bureaucracies.
These and other examples of collaborative networks show that, as governance strategies, they were beneficial and made a difference in their respective policy areas. and that the various supporting tools have lowered barriers to using the networked approach. However, in most cases, these networks could not sustain themselves over the long run because of difficulties with working in a collaborative environment, especially in the context of the traditional and self-sustaining hierarchical model. Currently, efforts are undertaken to address some of the more common challenges to creating and sustaining collaborative-based initiatives. On overcoming the challenges to the use of networks in government, when this special edition, the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, returns.